I'm Audrey Lukasak, and this is
Kutumbeni Kathindi from Namibia.
Okay. And we're glad that you are here tonight, because that is indicating to us that you have either an interest in Nicaragua or Namibia.
Or both.
And trying to figure out what this forum is going to be about. Let me just give you an idea of how we will be doing this evening. We will be going through, giving you a brief introduction on both countries, pulling some things together, opening it up for discussion, and at 10 o'clock we will break, and those who would like to continue to stay, both of us have slides of both those countries that we will be willing to share with you. I'm really excited to have this time tonight because I have to share two personal experiences of Namibia and Nicaragua, and what do they have in common. I went to Nicaragua two summers ago and have done a lot of speaking to different congregations and community groups about Nicaragua. And I had a lady call me and she says, our ALCW is studying Namibia. We can't find anybody to talk about Namibia, but we understand that you went to Nicaragua and would you please come and speak to our women's group. And I said, yes, I would. And she says, well, is Nicaragua near Namibia? Okay. I got a letter from the other experience. For those of you who do not know, and I don't mean to laugh, Nicaragua and Namibia are in two different continents, but with an ocean in between. But the other thing, I just got, but I'm what I'm trying to stress is that when people hear about Nicaragua and Namibia, especially now in the American Lutheran Church where both are being talked about, there is some concern of, you know, which one are we talking about now? I got a letter from my mother this past week. She was at the ALCW convention. Some people from Wisconsin came up to her and said, we heard your daughter speak to us about hunger in Namibia. So that's all my mom said. I hope she corrected them. But anyway, that's the reason why I'm excited to talk a little bit tonight about Namibia and Nicaragua, because the first evening that Kutumbeni came in, we sat down over dinner and just saw the same struggles in both of these countries. First of all, I'd like to just comment on three different things of why there's revolution going on in some third world countries in the world. Three causes of rebellion are, one is you have a relative economic decline. Oftentimes you have the middle class just breaking out or dropping and no longer existing. Another is political frustration, when people are no longer given any freedoms to do anything. And then the third is repression. As many of you may know about some of the history of Nicaragua, Nicaragua was under the control of Anastasio Somoza, or the Somoza family, for 45 years. It was a country that the United States supported both financially and militarily. We had troops in that country since the turn of the century and helped assist a National Guard. And much of the living under Somoza regime is much of what you hear in El Salvador and Guatemala today, that there was a lot of repression of the people. Most of the money that was sent to Somoza was put in his own bank account. At the time of the revolution in 1979, he had $500 million in his own personal bank account. He felt that he would rather have oxen than people with minds, educated minds, and so there was very little done as far as education and literacy. The economic situation was really poor. The majority of the people were poor. Many of them did not work. There was a lot of repression of the people. In 79, there was the revolution, and the Sandinistas, who for several years had been working for change, seeing that what was happening to much of the poor, said enough is enough. And there was the revolution in 79. There were four basic goals and philosophies of the Sandinistas, in which we are going to take those four goals of the Sandinistas government and compare Nicaragua and Namibia. The first of the fundamental pillars is nationalism. This is, you know, where people are, you know, the will of the people is to regain sovereignty. They are saying they want to determine their own destiny. We can see that in our own country and our revolution, if you look back at history of the only revolution in this country. It was also a feeling of that nationalism that they would even have the right to make their own mistakes and also to learn from them. And when you speak to many of the people in Nicaragua, you hear them saying, we are not a government, we are not a country that knows everything that is, or we're learning. Please give us some time. We will make mistakes. They have admitted to some things that they have done wrong, and they ask that you understand, especially with the Mosquito Indians, which is a whole other subject to talk about. But again, you know, they're learning from their mistakes. A second fundamental pillar is the democratic aspiration. Okay, much of what we base our foreign policy on, such as in El Salvador, we say we want a democracy there, so they have elections. Well, they are having elections in November, and they have waited this time to have elections for the whole country, partly because they did some very positive things after the revolution. One was the literacy campaign, a feeling that people needed to be educated before they made their choices. But with that, it includes, you know, real participation of the people. They are learning to organize themselves in their own barrios or their own areas of living. They are electing already people to represent those small areas. It includes, you know, the social democracy, the political democracy, and economic democracy. And with that comes the rights to learn, to read, to write, to have a family wage that you can live on, and just even the right to work in a peaceful setting. A third area is the Christian element, and that is the freedom of religion, that many of the people under Somoza regime were persecuted, or they were tortured or put in prison because they were thought very much the same situation as in El Salvador. But there is the Christian freedom of that. And the fourth one is the system of social justice. And this is a system of meaning and consequences for the people. You know, that it has, that life has a meaning, and that there is justice in life, and that it should be for everyone and not just a few of the elite, which used to be just the rich.
Namibia is a new name for, is an African name for Southwest Africa, which is a territory located in the southwestern corner of the continent of Africa. It was occupied by the Germans after the Berlin Conference of 1884. And when Germany was defeated during World War I, Namibia was given as a mandate to South Africa, who was British at that time. Since then, the Namibian people has been trying to gain their own independence from South Africa, which is politically, economically, and otherwise. And it is against this background of first the German colonialism and then the South African colonialism that the situation of Namibia is to be viewed. And there is war going on now in Namibia, because the Namibian people under SWAPO have struggled so much with all peaceful means, and finally they gave up and they decided they are going to fight South Africa to regain their own land. So it is a war between the Namibian people and South African soldiers. South Africa is trying to keep Namibia as a buffer between the independent Africa and then South Africa itself to maintain a status quo. And so it is that kind of situation we are living in. The territory of the size of Texas, with the people less than 2 million, which produce the most uranium in the world, the most diamonds on the continent of Africa, the third most copper on the continent, and many, many other base metals. So this whole situation is really escalating because South Africa has got now about 110,000 troops in Namibia, which is exactly 10% of the Namibian population, which has actually replaced the 10% of the Namibian population who has left the country as refugees, and they are stationed in neighboring countries like Zambia and Angola. And then there is the fighting force of SWAPO, which stands for Southwest Africa People's Organization, you know, among those, you know, refugees. To go over real quick, this was just an introduction to give you an idea what Namibia is and what is going on there. And with the people, less than 2 million people, the Namibian people have got goals which are pretty much the same with most oppressed nations, particularly Nicaragua, which is just trying to build itself through the revolution. And the economic system in Namibia is similar to that of South Africa, meaning that the whites are running the economy and politics, and they are exploiting the cheap labor from the black people. Then you have the multinational companies which are doing the mining and the business in South Africa, paying taxes and enjoying the cheap labor system. So it is that kind of economy which, you know, the Namibian people has gone through. And actually, our goals, as expressed in our one of our statements of our SWAPO party, is that of the spirit of nationalism, solidarity, freedom of religion, and justice. So you can see the parallel and the similarities with Nicaragua. And actually, the spirit of nationalism is to fight the fragmentations of South African policy of divide and rule, which is not only to divide the blacks and the whites, but also the blacks from the blacks. So with the African nationalism, we are actually building a nation. And we are struggling for this unity, and our goal is to establish a democratic government where all people will participate in their own affairs. And there is a very high factor of, as we said, you know, freedom of religion. In Namibia, we are talking about more than 80% of the Namibian population are Christians. And to get in details of that, you have about 70% of the Christians are Lutherans. And so, you know, you have a very, you know, Christian nation when you talk about Namibia. And then Fourthly, we are trying to establish our system of social justice whereby in the free Namibia, we want all people who are working for peace, whether black or white, are welcome to stay and build a nation, and they will be all treated equally, you know, by the law. And to do that, we need to gain the independence. And to gain the independence, we need a cooperation of other nations. Because we believe that peace can only come to Namibia if all involved parties, meaning South Africa and her friends, are willing to bring about a change to Namibia. We are going now to address the issue of U.S. involvement in both countries and open the discussion as well. Yeah, and that is mainly in the case of Namibia. We are trying to get the Western world persuade South Africa to give up Namibia, to leave Namibia alone, to let free and fair elections being administered by the United Nations so that the Namibian people can elect their own leader. And that's very hard. It's very hard for us to, you know, to just get that through, because the Western governments have demonstrated clearly that they are more interested in the business or in the wealth which their companies are accumulating and getting out of Namibia and South Africa, rather than putting up the human rights as a priority. And the Reagan administration has even so far decided to forget or make the world forget about Namibia and even put up an Angolan issue, thus drifting the whole attention from Namibia further back into Africa and maintaining the status quo. So that means that the Reagan administration is not ready, as far as I know as a Namibian citizen, being in Washington, D.C., if the Reagan administration comes back in the office, we are still talking about maybe 4 more years without Namibian independence. Because it's the only powerful nation which can persuade South Africa to negotiate peacefully about Namibian independence. And what that means is more bloodshed and more war going on in the northern part of Namibia, where South Africa occupies the whole area, including southern Angola. And so it is that kind of atmosphere that the Reagan administration has kept the whole Namibia as a hostage, that if Angola does not let the Cubans leave, then Reagan is not ready to negotiate any Namibian independence. The Cubans are in Angola because South Africa invaded Angola because they wanted to install a puppet government in Angola, so that they have two countries as a buffer zone between independent Africa, as I said, and South Africa. But when Angola cried for help, Cuba was the only country which sent troops there to help maintain Angolan sovereignty and freedom. And it's only recently, last year, when the Reagan administration even suggested to South Africa that, why don't you pull up an Angolan issue, you know, if you want to prolong more time, and, you know, we can buy more time that way. And so surely South Africa did. And this is all done in the name of, you know, defending the Western democracy and our whole African nationalism is completely ignored, because this whole issue is viewed in the East-West issue.
Many of you have probably heard much of what I'm about to say as far as the U.S. involvement in Nicaragua. It has hit the news in the past year. In some ways, it helps me when I'm speaking to groups because at least they are aware of some of those things. I think the biggest thing is the covert aid to the Contras. These are ex-Samosan National Guardsmen who are now mostly in Honduras. And we are financing those people. They are ones who have stated that they want to take over Nicaragua. They see that what the Sandinistas have been doing has been wrong. They do not feel that that there has been any good in the last 5 years. One of the things that the Reagan administration has also done, Nicaragua is in economic shambles right now. Part of the reason for that is many of the loans to that country have been cut off or blocked by the power the United States has with the IMF, I believe it's called. IMF for the national banks, yeah. And so that has really affected them. They have cut quotas, the sugar quotas, in the last year, and that is one of the major exports of Nicaragua. Also, because of the war that is going on the border, much of the money that they have been making has been going towards fighting that war. There have been negotiations. The Nicaraguan people, the government officials that we talked with, said we want to meet with the Reagan administration. They have been asking repeatedly to meet with some top official people. And the Reagan administration, Schultz did go down just on almost an unannounced stop, but for just such a short time. But they are willing, they want to sit down because they do not want to have what took place in Cuba, and they need the United States support to continue their goals, especially financially. The Contradora group, which is a group of different countries that are trying to bring a peaceful solution to the Central American and Caribbean countries, have been working together with the Nicaraguan people, and yet it's not moving. There are some peaceful solutions to the problems in Nicaragua, but it's through negotiations, and yet it's at a standstill. We'd like to, at this time, just open it up to questions, comments, clarification, whatever. Yes?
I had an understanding that, I'm not exactly sure what date it was, but that the United Nations declared or told South Africa to get out of Namibia several years ago.
It was 1966.
And they just have refused.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was 1966. Well, that's 18 years ago.
Aren't there five nations that have, of which the United States is only one of those five, that are supposed to ensure that Namibia does move toward independence?
There was such a group, the contact group of the five Western nations: United States, Canada, Britain, France, and West Germany. Recently, France withdrew from the contact group, apparently because of the new French government, charging that the group is not really serious with the question. And it was, in fact, just made to buy more time to maintain the status quo. So that group, as of now, is no longer really, in existence, because France withdrew and all other members came to agree that it hasn't achieved anything.
I would agree with that. I'm from Canada, and indirectly, there's a lot of good PR. We supposedly are boycotting South African goods, etc. But Canada is still supporting IMF aid in loans, etc. to South Africa. So it's obviously not in good conscience boycotting anything as far as South Africa goes. So Canada is just as guilty as the U.S. in hindering Namibia's freedom.
Yeah, that's very much true, because the U.S. and West Germany and Canada probably, well, of course, Britain cannot escape that. But you know, they really come out clear when we talk business. They deal with business more than with human rights. So that's a very good point of clarification.
Was although the country as itself will support the businesses, American businesses in South Africa or someplace like that where they have a good profit to be made, we as individuals could still not invest or put some pressure on some businesses which are investing in these South African countries. Do you happen to know offhand major U.S. corporations that have holdings in South African industries?
Whether I know of any...
Which major U.S. corporations have interest in South Africa that are helping support South African government?
Oh, well, there are more than 200 U.S. corporations, in fact, more. Unfortunately, I forgot to bring that list.
So, so many, I suppose it's more just of a general problem rather than specific.
Yeah, but all these car companies, General Motors, Amex, and... You know, many of these big companies, they invest heavily in South Africa. And in fact, see, the question of sanctions, economic sanctions, is such a powerful thing that even South Africa and their friends, they argue that they try to work so hardly against this question itself, because they know that once people come away and convinced about economic sanctions, you know, it's really going to bring about a change. So what they do is they try to make people, you know, that, well, economic sanction is not, you know, going to work and we are going to hurt more blacks. And people are already suffering in South Africa. You really don't expect anything worse than what is going on now in South Africa and Namibia. It's such a terrible situation there.
Because even... Although there's so many corporations, I know there's certain specific ones that people mention that have more investments in helping the government and so on. I know that even the major church colleges, Lutheran church colleges, have holdings in these corporations which help support South African governments.
The American Lutheran Church still has investments.
You know, it's sort of the beginning of a flow for students and others helping to bring this to the attention. But I'm afraid that while it still makes a profit, it's still the investments.
Pursuing that point, Robert, would you speak to the point that I've heard made that if by some magic stroke that these American countries were to withdraw their holding, that they would be immediately displaced by Russian interests and others, which would make the situation even more miserable. I'm not speaking to the validity of that. Is that a valid statement or is it not?
You want a comment from both countries?
Well, we were talking about Namibia. Maybe it pertains to all of them. I don't know. But this is the argument that I've heard. That, I don't remember where, but it was to the effect that, well, there is that much wealth, as you mentioned, resources, and if the United States does not provide the capital to develop them, then some other less friendly people, if there is such a thing, would be in there taking their place. And the situation would not be enhanced, if not even deteriorated.
Well, the argument is that if the Western nations withdraw their business in South Africa and Namibia, that the Eastern Bloc may come and take over? Well, as far as we are concerned, that whole argument is still going in circles about business. It's still you know, it's not still a question of human rights, see? You know, and, you know, whether you are afraid that, you know, the other guy will come around, it's still business-wise. The human right factor is not yet involved, see? And, you know, so that's, you know, what we are saying, that we think that it will be much more beneficial if arguments and forums and discussions would be based on human rights issues and not on business, see? Because that's just one way of looking at this problem in East-West light, either black or white, see? You know, we withdraw and those guys will come in. And that's still not yet human rights issue, see?
The resources are there, I presume. And if Namibia is to grow and be independent, somehow or another, it has to develop those resources and export them and so forth. Would Namibia have the capital to do that? Would they have the resources to do that? I don't know.
Oh, well, yeah, one thing, most Western countries forget to realize looking in that is that, you see, all these countries which have been Western colonies, you know, they obviously cannot jump from, you know, one line to another. If there is to be a realistic dealing with economy of each country, I think it has to be viewed in the light where it is at that point, just like Zimbabwe, what it's doing now. So many Western leaders are not comfortable with Mugabe, but he is dealing with with the Zimbabwean economy the way he found it, and is trying to, you know, gear it gradually towards the benefit of his own people. That means you still have Western companies doing business in Zimbabwe now, after 4 years of independence, and you know, they are doing their best. So it's that kind of road we are facing in Namibia. That, you know, all our people, most of our people have been educated in the West. The economy so far has been directed towards the Western way of doing business. So, you know, there is no point of getting scared and paranoid about, you know, this, you know, losing business question. So, but our question is mainly aimed at what are people? Are people benefiting from their own resources? That's the main question. So, and whosoever would like to, you know, to do business have to make sure that, have to agree to that, that we get a better share, because it is our world.
I'm just going to ask you a question, was that in Nicaragua? Is that an issue in Nicaragua also?
Our administration, present administration, has made that an issue. This spring, President Reagan had a press conference, and in his speech within the first half hour, he referred to communist Nicaragua 23 times as part of the propaganda campaign there. He has also referred to it as a domino effect. What has taken place in Nicaragua will carry through the rest of Central America. At the time of the revolution, Nicaragua called out to all countries, both East and Western countries, and asked, we need medical help, we need teachers to be part of our education and health reform, and we need people to come. The United States sent very few people. Cuba sent a large number. Many of the European countries, along with the Soviet Union, sent people to help with that. Nicaragua does, because of the economic situation, does not want to become dependent on any specific country to help them out with that. They do 20% of their trade with the Soviet Union, and they are searching for other places. They want to form a trade with the United States. They do not want to, like I said, become dependent on the Soviet Union. Some people have said, well, the freedoms in Nicaragua, they don't have the freedoms. I mean, it's going to be a communist country. And my question is, and I used to think a lot different than I do now, and so please understand me, but I really was confused when I went down 2 years ago of just a lot of the terminology of socialism, capitalism, communists, you know, Marxist, Leninists. And so it is very confusing yet to me. But I used to think that when I heard communist, that it was really bad. When people, when you think of what life is like in a under a communist country, if you describe that to me, I can tell you that I did not see that in Nicaragua. That you have the many of the same kind of freedoms as we do in Nicaragua.
There are a lot of manipulations of facts as well. Last year in Poland, we had some discussion on Nicaragua and Zimbabwe and Egypt, and there were points raised about how there were bread and milk shortages, and the reasons, obviously, the Western people said it was because they have had revolution and they are now communist, and therefore things have gone to pot. In fact, what happened is that the poor people were now able to buy these things. Therefore, there were shortages because they had never had access to these things. They could then buy them. The shortages then occurred. So because people were able to gain these basic staples of life, they had shortages. And it's the interpretation of these facts, depending on which side of the fence you're on, that makes people say communism or whatever. And it's a sad misleading of the events.
Another comment about that, we had met with the spring with the ambassador from Nicaragua to the United States, and I just lost my train of thought, but of what you were saying is that, again, the information is very confusing of what we hear through that, and we asked about, well, what about the domino effect that we hear about? Well, Nicaragua has so many problems of its own that, you know, they want to just work on their goals of the revolution for themselves. And it's a system that hasn't really been tried before. It's very unique. And maybe it is a model for some of the countries in Central America.
In what capacity did you go down there? In what capacity
okay.
did you go down?
I went through the ALC Hunger Program and through the Center for Global Education and Service out of Augsburg College. And I went as a representative of the Southern Wisconsin District Church and Society Committee.
Thank you.
And I went out of ignorance, not knowing what was going on, and confusion of just, I couldn't tell what was going on. So, yeah.
Were you in any of the areas occupied by Mosquito Indians?
We did not go to the East Coast because of the tension there, and we were there for 8 days. We spent time with two different people who were working with the Mosquito Indians, and one was a Mary Knoll missionary and a wife of a pastor who was working really closely with the Sandinistas in trying to work on the problems there.
In contrasting Namibia and Nicaragua, we hear, you know, our own press, and we really don't know world opinion, but it seems to me that world opinion outside the U.S. is more sympathetic to the Sandinistas than it is SWAPO. Is that correct?
Oh, I would say, oh, definitely, yes. That is, as far as I'm acquainted with, SWAPO is a very much popular worldwide, maybe except in the U.S. And that is mainly because...
I didn't hear you. Did you say it's popular worldwide?
Yes,
it's not popular or is more popular?
It's more popular and well known in the.
Is it supported by other countries outside the U.S.?
Outside the U.S., right, and of course by minor groups like, you know, and church groups in the U.S. But people like in Europe are more conscious and familiar with what SWAPO is doing and what SWAPO is all about, and the whole Namibian situation rather than in the United States.
And I would have to say that's with the Sandinistas too. We met with several other groups from different European countries while we were down there, and the awareness was much stronger of what was going on in Nicaragua, and those countries over in Europe are working closely with the Sandinistas.
Just to add one more thing to that is because the reason why I'm saying that is because we have a lot of SWAPO students, Namibian students who left Namibia as refugees, and they got scholarships in Eastern Europe, Scandinavian countries. You know, in Europe you find many, many, many SWAPO students, and there is only a handful in this country. And those who are in this country are only studying under the United Nations scholarship. And this is again, you know, what you're saying, that the Western nations are very good at screaming, please don't become communist. And yet they are not really doing anything concrete. You know, so we think that they are not very serious with our problem.
Could you tell us a little bit more about like the average wage that people earn under the multinational corporations and the kind of life it provides for them? Just what is the standard of living like for these people?
Is there any other question related to this so that I can answer it together about the Namibian situation? Okay, anyway. Well, I used to work for a uranium company, which is owned by American, Canadian, and British companies. And with my high school certificate, I was working with a white South African who had the same qualification. And, you know, I used to get $150 per month. And he used to get $2,800 per month. You know, so, and I was one of the highest guys, in the mine, earning that amount. And so that's just one example. But, you know, the whole machinery of the, economic system is really incredible to see how the whole system has been set up. For example, the black young boys are being encouraged to leave school at the age of 15, And then they are being paid $5 per month. And then they have to be on a contract for 18 to 24 months working for a white farmer, either kitchen boy or looking after the sheep, And with these proper credentials signed by the boss, then he can get employment in the factories or mines. And the hope is that he will have, learned how to obey the master, see? So that all the mine workers and factory workers in Namibia have gone through that kind of, training, see? It was really a surprise to the South African government in 1971 when 3,000 workers in Namibia went on strike on one day. Namibia, when you have less than 2 million people, 2,000 workers is a very large number. So the government was really shocked that, how come all these people are supposed to have, known better, but, they all went on a strike, on one day. And so it was really a shock to the government. And so, most of these people still, they used to earn $50 per month, $200 per month if, they are better off. So, and then the education system is not free in Namibia for black students. And it's incredible to see how that system works, but still people know their rights. So SWAPO was based, by the workers. Actually, it was the workers who raised up peacefully and demonstrated and went on strike, and it was all all in vain. So that's why most of them, they left the country out of frustrations. you know, and exploitation, and they wanted to decide their own lot.
Do you want to know on Nicaragua, as far as lifestyle?
Yeah.
Okay. I cannot give a figure as far as an average wage. Do you know, Katie?
Well, you have to talk about whether you're talking about under Somoza or you're talking about
okay.
Now.
Present. Mm-hmm. What I heard, these are two other people who just went this spring to Nicaragua, so they can help answer this. But what we heard from some of the factory workers that we talked with, they said, we may not be making much more than what we were under Somoza, but the conditions, the working conditions are much better. We now are able to form unions. We are able to have breaks, coffee breaks. There's one factory, they had just built a cafeteria that was, you know, giving very cheap meals. People said that they could, you know, if there was a problem, they could deal with that. They said housing was cheaper. They also indicated that transportation, some of the factories would pay their transportation to and from work, their working hours were less. And the other thing with the revolution, there was the agrarian reform program, which has been very successful, that much of the land that was owned by Somoza, which was a good portion of the country, was then given to farmers, to anyone who wanted to produce on the land. It was given to them under the conditions that it had to be farmed. Land that is owned by anybody in that country, if it is not being productive, is taken away from them. So the conditions for living were much better.
Except for the fact that so much of their resources and their energy has to be devoted to defending their borders from the attacks by the counter-revolutionaries that are paid for by our own. So things are really very, very difficult for people.
Mm-hmm. And again, there's a lot of shortages because they are not able to get the trade.
We had the privilege of hosting a Baptist pastor in May for Central America Information Week here in Washington State. And he said that for all during Holy Week, there was no milk for his children. And the reason there was no milk for his children to drink was that the ship that was carrying the powdered milk to Nicaragua had been blown up by the mine in the harbor placed there by CIA bad people.
It's interesting, too, to note that one of the arguments that our government uses for not supporting the Sandinista government is that they are spending such a large percentage of their monies on military. And so,
isn't it crazy? Yeah. It's a self-fulfilled prophecy.
They have like a 20,000 member army, but they have 60,000 militia, people in the militia. So that's another argument that the administration says. Why do they have such a large army? Well, there's a difference between the militia and the regular army. Faith, you had
a... I was just curious about the press. Someone had, when I was arguing about this, had brought up the fact that, or maybe it's not a fact, is there a free press in Nicaragua, or is it censored, or how's...
Okay, there are three newspapers in Nicaragua. Two of them are controlled by the government. One is an opposition newspaper. And that is part of the visit that the center provides, that we visit both Barricada, which is government-owned, and La Prensa, which is the opposition on that. Yes, La Prensa has been censored at times. But the reason, one thing that I have to stress about that is For one thing, you are allowed to have an opposition newspaper even exist in a country like that. In El Salvador, the editors of the opposition newspaper were killed, and the newspaper was blown up. So, you know, here we are supporting the government in El Salvador that does not allow an opposition newspaper. But in Nicaragua, even though it's at times censored and shut down for a day or so, you know, there's that.
What I understand about that censorship, too, is it's not as simple as it sometimes looks. It may not be the most just thing to censor a newspaper, but, and you can correct me if this is the wrong view, but isn't the concern that if the presses were free, the people with the money, which is mostly people who are left over from the Somoza regime, would control the newspapers just because they had the money, and there would be a great deal of thought control that way, too. That's the argument that I've heard used. Mm-hmm. Could you respond to that? Because that freedom of the press issue is such a sticky one.
Right. I guess I would say it's increased the shutdowns or the censorships since the war has increased on the border, and being careful of what is going on there. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, one thing that does come to mind to me is the censorship that we experienced in the United States when the invasion of Grenada took place. that was just totally wiped out until after the invasion. But one thing that we noticed, we went and talked to the La Prensa people also, and they are censored daily. But the uncensored portion is put outside the newspaper on a bulletin board, and anybody who cares to read the uncensored version can. Mm-hmm.
Just a sideline. The editor of Veracada and La Prensa are brothers. And their mother used to be part of the ruling junta of the Sandinistas. Dan.
Yeah, I've been out of the village and read some newspapers.
Updated.
Out of interest, I say censorship of the opposition press has been less lifted except for military matters. At least that's the current status. Secondly, the unfortunate occurrence now in Nicaragua, it seems like the major opposition parties have decided to boycott the elections. Which I think is it's the Reagan administration will use that then to prove that that it isn't a free election. Also, SWAPO just turned down a peace proposal by the South African government, and the newspaper, in typical fashion, called SWAPO rebels. You know, it's always interesting to watch what words are used. Marxist rebel in our newspapers will become sensitive to that. And I'd be curious if they didn't really articulate it, but, you know, probably what kind of a peace proposal that was that stopped at this turn around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
From what I've heard you say this evening, I hear the name Reagan mentioned several times. Are we to presume that these situations that we're talking about are unique to the Reagan administration, or have they been a continuing policy of the United States under any administration? You mentioned 1966. In other words, something's been going on for a long time. Is this an official position of the United States, or is it a particular party or president?
Well,
in other words, what does Jimmy Carter do about some of these things we're talking about?
Yeah, okay. Well, as far as I came to this country in 1979, and the difference I have noticed between the Reagan administration and the Carter administration is that the Reagan administration has a so-called constructive engagement, which is supposed to negotiate the peaceful means of for Namibian independence, and actually, and moreover, the Reagan administration is strongly supporting the UNITA rebels in Angola who are trying to overthrow the Angolan government. So, you know, it's much more clear that, you know, the Reagan administration is really working. And it's, as I said, it's the Reagan administration which brought up the Cuban linkage. So, you know, it's more clear that the present government is working to maintain the status quo. As far as the past earlier administrations are concerned, I really don't know any administration which took up the issue very, very seriously and pushing South Africa so strongly to bring about. There were not any, you know, better really for, as far as we are concerned as Namibians. But as things are now, things are getting worse with the present administration.
So we would presume then that a new administration would reverse some of these practices and attitudes and would help the Namibian situation improve?
May I just respond to that? We are neighbors of Namibia, what is clear about the present administration is that things have only been, things have escalated from what they were. In the current administration, it seemed clear that President Tharo was putting the human rights issue ahead of anything else. And although it didn't do a lot of improvements, but it did speak against that. And when President Reagan came into office, he took over, re-established military ties in South Africa, and thereby with Namibia, and started selling some weapons and control towns, controlling crowds and cattle. And those are very much clear indications that he was kind of trying to turn the grid back. Those others didn't make much progress, but at least they were trying to withdraw and in the form of helping South Africa. But he came to office and reestablished all of the positive, the possible help he could get to the South African government. And that's the reason we are so critical of him.
And for 45 years, the United States, well, first of all, they did when the president in Nicaragua, and for 45 years promoted the Somoza dynasty, which was doing a lot of terrible things to the people in Nicaragua. At the time of the Carter administration was also the same time that the revolution took place. They put a hold on a lot of things until they wanted to wait and see what was going to be happening with the new government there. And that was at the time when Reagan also came in.
So there is a distinction in Central America, especially a real clear one between how Carter behaved and how Reagan is behaving. Carter let things happen, let the revolution take place there, and see what the will of the people was. And it seems that Reagan is trying to determine what the will of the people should be in Central America. These are two different attitudes.
I am going to just end with one comment that I heard a couple weeks ago that just really hit home to me, and then invite people to stay if they want to see any slides. It'll be about 10 minutes on Namibia and 10 minutes on Nicaragua and Mexico. It'll be just real quick because it is late. But someone said a couple weeks ago to me that there will be more or less people killed depending on what we decide to do. And I think as Christians and also citizens of this country, we need to do something. Thank you.